Court of Appeals. On my right is Justice Bob McCoy. On my left is Justice William Meyer, and I'm Justice Terry Livingston. We only have one case on our 9:30 docket. If the clerk will please announce counsel. Thank you. Mr. Siegel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Charles Siegel from Waters and Krause, and with me is Lauren Jacobson from our office. We represent the appellant, Mrs. Smith. I want to start by thanking the court for continuing the argument from last time. I was in no condition to be here, and I appreciate the accommodation. As the court is aware, this is an appeal from a summary judgment granted to one of a number of defendants in a mesothelioma asbestos case. It is important, I think, it's very important to take stock of what is not disputed in this case and what the trial courts, or when I refer to the trial court, it's the MDL court that hears all pretrial motions in all Texas asbestos cases, Judge Davidson, what his ruling came down to. There's no dispute in this case that Mr. Smith, Norman Smith, was a career drywaller whose job entailed heavy exposure to asbestos every day. There's no dispute that he died of mesothelioma and that disease, both generally and in his case, was caused by his asbestos exposure. There's no dispute that he was exposed on a regular basis to Kelly Moore's product. There's no dispute that that product contained chrysotile asbestos in varying percentages from year to year. And there's no dispute that chrysotile asbestos, the kind of asbestos in this product, causes mesothelioma. That is stipulated for purposes of this motion that was agreed to by Kelly Moore below. All of those concessions are repeated at page 6 of Kelly Moore's brief in this case. What was then the basis of the ruling? The ruling was the further contention, or the basis of the motion was the further contention by Kelly Moore that in this case we did not have evidence that was sufficient to allow the jury to conclude that Kelly Moore, that exposure to the Kelly Moore product was a cause, not the cause, not the only cause, not the but-for cause, but a cause of the mesothelioma. And another thing I think it's important to remember, or for the court to understand, is how juries try these asbestos cases, how they decide them, how the parties try them. Very briefly, in a man like, with a man like Norman Smith, who's a very, very typical lifelong Texas asbestos exposed person, career occupational exposure, he's exposed to a number of different products. If the jury decides that the makers of each of those products was negligent, or for those manufacturers that they do decide were negligent, how do juries determine how to allocate causal responsibility? Sometimes they decide that a particular company wasn't negligent or didn't know of the hazards of asbestos and so on. Sometimes they decide that, well, we just don't believe the plaintiff. He didn't sound that believable when he said he remembered this product versus that product, or he didn't quite remember what this label looked like versus that label. None of that really happened in this case. There's no dispute, again, that he was exposed to a Kelly Moore product on a regular basis which contained asbestos. So the only basis for the holding by Judge Davidson, and indeed the only basis for the motion, was that there is no evidence, remember, no evidence, that a jury could base a decision to allocate some, not all, causal responsibility to Kelly Moore. Again, typically in these cases, the juries arrive at a list of defendants, A, they think were negligent, and B, made a product the plaintiff was exposed to, and then, roughly, admittedly, but that's how we do multiple defendant cases in Texas, and we always have, not just in asbestos, but in any kind of case, the jury arrives at some basis for parceling out the responsibility. So, was there no evidence in this case of causation, of specific causation? And, of course, the bottom contention, at bottom, the contention of Kelly Moore was that the plaintiffs don't have evidence of the specific dose to which Mr. Smith was exposed for a Kelly Moore product. They don't have enough.
Aren't they really just asking for a proof or evidence of a threshold of a dose.
That's
as
one.
As opposed to a specific quantifiable dose.
I don't think Kelly Moore's counsel would limit himself that at that level, but I think that's what's required. And then the question becomes, is there some evidence in this record of a threshold exposure that would allow a jury to properly attribute some, not all, some causation to Kelly Moore? And what is that threshold? Well, Borg, Warner, and Stevens say you've got to have some evidence specific to the product. And in our brief, we made the argument that Stevens was wrongly decided and that it was too stringent a standard, in some sense impossible for plaintiffs to meet. And frankly, I regret making that our first argument in our brief. I think our stronger argument is the argument we set out, I think, in greater detail in the reply brief, which is we're okay under Stevens. This court doesn't have to overrule Stevens to, or not overrule it, this court doesn't have to disagree with Stevens to find that summary judgment was improperly granted in this case. And what is the evidence that we have that was lacking in the record in Borg Warner and Stevens? I've made a handout, and I have a board for this, because I think it's very important, and I walked through these calculations in the reply brief, and I want to go through them again very briefly. And again, none of this is disputed. It's important to remember that there was no challenge to any of the admissibility of evidence, in this case. There was no challenge to the conclusions of any expert. The entire basis of the motion was whatever the plaintiffs say, if you take all of that evidence as a given, it's not enough for the jury to base causation on in Texas, not even a scintilla. Well, what is the evidence in this case that was lacking in Borg Warner and Stevens? I want to go through it very briefly, and then I want to highlight the relevant parts of those cases and show why our record is different. In this case, we had evidence. All of this was from the plaintiff's experts. And again, it's fibers per cubic centimeters per year, and you have these calculations. This is a fiber cc here. It's a worker exposed to one fiber per cc for a normal 2,000-hour work year. 0.15 fibers would be a fraction of that. That would equal, you know, one fiber for 300 hours, 10 fibers for 30 hours. Okay, that's how we measure the exposure. Then we need to learn what were the levels of exposure that are caused by this kind of work with this kind of product. Again, none of this is disputed. Dr. Longo, mixing Kelly Moore joint compounds, 1.2 to 14.1, and you get similar numbers for sanding the joint compounds and cleaning up the joint compounds. Again, I'm already sounding like a broken record, but Kelly Moore doesn't dispute that Gordon Smith did that every day of his career. Nor do they dispute that he did it a regular amount, a significant amount, a frequent amount with their product. Then we have to take that level and we have to see the levels of exposure generated by work with a Kelly Moore product or by work with joint compound products generally. And we have to see what type of a total exposure that works out to. Well, we get, you know, 25 to 37.5 hours of exposure over a lifetime. This is what you get at these levels. Now, is that expected to cause mesothelioma? Is that a basis on which, is that a permissible basis? Is that sufficient evidence for a jury to maybe decide that Kelly Moore was a cause of this man's disease?
The other board is the end calculation. We go through this in our brief. In order to increase his risk of contracting mesothelioma eightfold, Mr. Smith would have had to work with Kelly Moore joint compounds at the most 250 hours, or basically 10 and a half days, and at the least 7.5 hours during his lifetime. Now, that's for an eightfold risk. Havner
only requires a doubling of the risk. And of course, there's a lot of back and forth in the briefs as to whether Havner even really requires a doubling of the risk as an absolute requirement in all cases. We say not because mesothelioma is a signature disease, but all of that is really academic at this point because we have this evidence that we say meets Borg-Warner and Stevens in spades.
Let me ask a question to clarify. But is there a concern, though, that we really don't have sufficient facts to show what percentage of Kelly Moore compounds were used as opposed to the other 20 or so compounds that were testified to?
I'll agree that there is no, well, I guess I have a two-part answer to that. I'll agree that there is no very specific evidence that, you know, Mr. Dorman Smith saying, I used Kelly Moore 23% of the time and Mirko 38% of the time and so on. We don't have that level of quantification. And, of course, that's impossible. If that is the standard in Texas asbestos cases, then Texas mesothelioma victims alone in the entire country will go uncompensated because a career man who works with a number of products day in and day out for 30 years cannot testify with that level of specificity. What we do have in this case is evidence. We have evidence of two things. We have a sort of offhand statement to the effect that he and his son used Mirko more than any other product. Then we have some evidence that, quote, I used Kelly Moore on a regular basis. There's also evidence that he said, well, we didn't use it that much because it was expensive. Later, his son testified, we used it on a pretty regular basis. Now, would that require the jury to assign liability to Kelly Moore? Of course not. Maybe the jury would hear the testimony at trial and think that Brady Smith, the son, isn't quite remembering it as well as he remembers Mirko. But think about how this trial would have been conducted. What happened was the case went to trial, started trial against Mirko, and eventually settled with Mirko in the middle of trial. But think about what would have happened at the trial of this case. And this is, you have to look at the pretrial order, which was signed by Judge Davidson when he sent the case back to its original county of filing, Tarrant County. And in that pretrial order at page 6, on paragraph 65, and this is tab 2 of our appendix to our brief, he says, the jury shall not hear any evidence of exposure to Kelly Moore or Union Carbide or one other that I can't remember right now. So think about how this trial would have unfolded. The only evidence the jury would have heard about is exposure to Mirko. And so Mirko was looking, because having gotten a summary judgment in its favor, having lost our case against Kelly Moore, and the judge having ruled that there was no evidence from which a jury could conclude that Kelly Moore was a cause, we would, of course, argue, we did argue to Judge Davidson in the pretrial hearing, well, gee, Judge, since the jury can't do anything with this evidence because it's not enough, then it would be, of course, improper for Kelly Moore to be on the jury form as a third party. You've already ruled they can't be responsible, so they can't be a third party responsible either. So take them off the verdict form. And that's what happened. He said that in the pretrial order. So we would have had this, frankly, crazy trial in which the judge would, in which the jury would only have heard about Mirko exposure, and it would not have heard about Kelly Moore exposure, notwithstanding the fact that there was a lot of evidence that he used Kelly Moore product on a regular basis. So it sets up this sort of distorted way of trying cases in which, presumably because there was this offhand comment that we used Mirko more than anything else, Judge Davidson let that defendant go to the jury, but didn't let the claim against Kelly Moore or Bondex go to the jury, and we have not pursued the appeal to this point against Bondex, or we abandoned the appeal to Bondex, because the evidence was weaker as to Bondex. But they wouldn't have heard about the Kelly Moore exposure, and the trial would have proceeded in that sort of funny vacuum, which I don't think makes sense. It's great for Kelly Moore in this case. It may not be great the next time a man happens to say, well, I think I use Kelly Moore more than anything else because I live down the block from the Kelly Moore, you know, from the store where I bought it or something. So who knows? I just think this is not the way to try a case like this, and it's not the way Texas juries, I think, and lawyers are accustomed to trying multiple defendant cases, going back, you know, to the hoary old Landers versus East Texas saltwater disposal case, where you have the two currents flowing into one. Do we have the kind of evidence that was missing in Stevens? Just to look at, I'm about out of time here, so I'm just going to look at the Stevens opinion. On the last page of the opinion, this is page 313, but it's the last page of the opinion. The court says, although the literature and scientific studies the Stevens' experts relied upon support a reasonable inference that exposure to chrysotile asbestos can increase a worker's risk of developing mesothelioma, none of the studies undertake the task of linking the minimum exposure level or dosage of joint compound with a statistically increased risk of developing the disease. What we have that was missing in Stevens is the Rodelsberger study that says 7.9 times the background rate, 7.9 times elevated risk from that kind of work. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Siegel. Mr. Morgan.
May it please the court, I'm Craig Morgan representing Appalachian Kelly Moore Paint Company. The most interesting thing perhaps about the plaintiff's position is that they have virtually abandoned what the position they took below. The argument they made below and what they made in their opening brief in this court was that they didn't have to meet the requirements of Borg Warner versus Flores because that just dealt with asbestosis and not mesothelioma, and that the decision in Georgia Pacific versus Stevens was wrong. That's the argument they made in the trial court, and that's the argument they made in their opening brief. It was not until their reply brief in this court that the plaintiffs undertook an effort to try to come up with, calculate an approximation of dose that they could attribute to Kelly Moore's product. So the easiest response is the trial judge was under no obligation to try to comb through the record and do the calculation of dose that the plaintiffs did not present the trial court, did not present this court, until their reply brief in the Court of Appeals. So that's the easy response. But the deeper response is that their entire argument contending that they do meet the requirements of BorgWarner and Havner and Georgia Pacific is that it's based on at least three fundamental mistakes about the evidence in this record that they would probably prefer be overlooked. The first is the simple fact that asbestos is not a precise term with any specific chemical meaning. It is instead an informal term used to describe six different mineral silicate fibers that vary not only in their chemical composition, but in their fiber types and shapes. The evidence the plaintiffs themselves presented to the trial court confirmed that of those six types, chrysotile is the one that's not called an amphibole. The other five types of asbestos are called amphiboles. And those five types of asbestos, according to the plaintiff's own evidence, are vastly more potent causes of mesothelioma than is chrysotile. In fact, at least one of the studies the plaintiffs submitted indicated that other forms of asbestos are at least 100 times more powerful a cause of mesothelioma than is chrysotile. Now, this is important, of course, because chrysotile is the only form of, quote, asbestos that was ever used in Kelly Moore's joint compound. So the plaintiff's efforts to use studies purportedly showing the causation of mesothelioma by, quote, asbestos are misleading, to put it gently. They're no more meaningful than would the plaintiff's evidence in Havner have been if they had attempted to produce studies showing that prescription drugs cause birth defects. The substance at issue in Havner was Bendectin, a precisely identifiable chemical compound sold as a drug by the defendant, Merrill Dow. The plaintiff's evidence had to be that substance, Bendectin, increases the risk of birth defects, not that prescription drugs as a category cause birth defects. The plaintiffs are attempting to make the same approach here. They're attempting to say, well, chrysotile is a type of asbestos, like Bendectin is a type of prescription drug. We have evidence that asbestos causes mesothelioma, like prescription drugs cause birth defects. Therefore, we can meet the requirements of Havner, BorgWarner, and Georgia-Pacific. This is a critical threshold point to keep in mind. The substance at issue here is not, quote, asbestos. It is chrysotile. The plaintiffs have no evidence showing the dose of chrysotile necessary to increase the risk of causing mesothelioma. That's the second of the three fundamental factual errors in this record that the plaintiffs would like the court to overlook about the evidence in this record. There is no evidence in this record of the threshold dose of chrysotile necessary to cause mesothelioma. In fact, there is no evidence of what exposure to chrysotile is necessary to produce any statistically detectable increase in mesothelioma at all. The two studies, including the Rottlesberger study to which they just referred, dealt with, quote, asbestos. And that study specifically noted, as we pointed out in our brief, that it could not distinguish chrysotile, despite what that study said was its known importance of that distinction. And there has to be a threshold, obviously. As the court noted in BorgWarner, the plaintiffs contend that everybody is exposed to asbestos in the background, and yet that background does not cause mesothelioma, and yet every exposure causes mesothelioma. That's just not possible. If background exposure, if the chrysotile asbestos in the air to which everyone is exposed does not cause mesothelioma, there has to be a threshold level that must be reached before a statistically detectable increase in that disease occurs. They've presented no evidence of what that level is. And Havner requires, incidentally, not just that there be a level at which the causation can be detected. It requires proof of the level at which the causation, the risk of that disease, doubles, because that's the proof that the Texas Supreme Court found in Havner will be consistent with the law in our jurisdiction requiring that the plaintiff prove causation by being more likely than not. They have to show that exposure to that substance would double the risk of the disease. There's no evidence of an exposure to chrysotile that will double the risk of mesothelioma. The third factual point the plaintiffs probably like this court to overlook about the evidence in this record, is that there is no evidence at all that drywall workers who, as the plaintiffs point out, are exposed to the dust from asbestos-containing joint compound day after day, week after week, month after month, for years and decades. There's no evidence that those drywall workers have any detectable increased risk of mesothelioma at all. There's no evidence that drywall workers have mesothelioma any more often than the general population. Now, if their theory were correct, surely there would be a study somewhere that shows that drywall workers have more mesothelioma than everybody else. And furthermore, that would include any kind of asbestos contained in joint compound. Kelly Moore's joint compound contained only chrysotile. But as we point out in our brief, other types of joint compound have different kinds of asbestos. And yet, even with all the kinds of asbestos contained in drywall joint compound, there's not a single study anywhere that shows that that drywall workers, such as Mr. Smith, exposed on a regular basis to inhaling this allegedly toxic substance that the plaintiffs say they took conclusively proved will cause mesothelioma, have any greater increased risk of mesothelioma than you or I or anyone else in the courtroom.
Go ahead, Chief. Was there any evidence that the products that were testified to, as opposed to Kelly Moore products, that those had the chrysotile asbestos as opposed to any other kind of asbestos?
Not for causation, no. No, now there's a distinction here. Now what the plaintiffs want to do is show that they tested exposure levels. In other words, if you grind up chrysotile-containing asbestos, you can measure how many fibers there are in the air. Now, they may have those studies, but I don't believe they even have that, actually. The studies about exposure limits do not distinguish chrysotile from other forms of asbestos, but there is no study at all showing that exposure, that the level at which exposure to chrysotile asbestos doubles the risk of getting mesothelioma. much less any evidence that the plaintiff's exposure to Kelly Moore's chrysotile-containing drywall joint compound doubled the risk of mesothelioma. Mm-hmm. I'll make one point even further, extending that. There is no evidence in this record that Dorman Smith's risk of getting mesothelioma would have been doubled if he had used nothing but Kelly Moore's drywall joint compound as the only drywall joint compound he had ever used during his entire life. So the fact that the plaintiffs have belatedly in their reply brief come up with an effort to calculate how what percentage it would have been of the total that Kelly Moore might have constituted of the total number of joint types of joint compounds Smith used over his 30-year career is irrelevant. Because even if one assumes that Mr. Smith had used nothing but Kelly Moore's drywall joint compound and never touched another brand, there is no evidence at all that that would have increased his risk of mesothelioma in a statistically recognizable way, detectable way, much less sufficient to show that it would have satisfied Havner by showing that that level was doubled. Now, quite simply, this court is being asked by Kelly Moore to confirm the rule that in this state, a plaintiff claiming to be injured by an asbestos-containing product must meet the same standards of proving causation that the plaintiff in any other toxic tort case must meet. That was the position we took below, the position we've taken all along, and the plaintiffs are beginning to back off in their opposition to that because they realize it's a futile effort. Their only effort to distinguish BorgWarner, which is the case which answered if it was ever legitimately in dispute whether Havner applies to asbestos cases, is indistinguishable. The only basis that the plaintiffs suggest on which that should be ignored was that, well, mesothelioma is a signature disease that is almost always caused by asbestos. Well, it's bewildering why they think that would distinguish this case from BorgWarner. After all, in BorgWarner, Flores had asbestosis. The jury found he had asbestosis. That finding was not challenged on appeal, and the Texas Supreme Court, throughout its analysis, took as a given that he had asbestosis. Asbestosis, by definition, is caused only by the inhalation of asbestos. It is not just a signature disease. It's by definition when it is caused by asbestos. It's impossible to distinguish Flores from mesothelioma on the ground that mesothelioma is caused by asbestos, usually. Because asbestosis, the disease that was at issue in Flores, is always caused by asbestos inhalation. It was taken as a given in that case that Mr. Flores's lung condition had been caused by inhaling asbestos. But that did not excuse the plaintiffs from the burden of proving causation. The court acknowledged also that the evidence was uncontested that BorgWarner's brake pads contained asbestos and that Flores would have breathed the dust from those brake pads during the course of his job. That was taken as a given. But that did not satisfy the plaintiff's proof of necessity to prove causation because there was no evidence of the dose of asbestos from BorgWarner's pads compared to the other brake pads. There was no evidence of a threshold dose necessary to have caused the disease by inhaling asbestos from brake pads. There was no evidence by which to compare BorgWarner's exposure of BorgWarner's to other pads, and there was no evidence of the doubling of the risk of asbestosis among brake mechanics. Well, compare that to this case. The plaintiffs say, well, Smith was exposed to Kelly Moore's asbestos-containing drywall joint compound, and he would have breathed the dust from that joint compound. That's the same as Flores. Because there's no evidence of the dose that was presented to the trial court of the percentage by which that Kelly Moore's drywall joint compound would have contributed to the total exposure. There's no evidence of a threshold dose of inhaling chrysotile asbestos that would cause mesothelioma. There's no evidence of a doubling of the risk of mesothelioma among those who breathe asbestos-containing joint compounds every day for their entire lives. This is indistinguishable from Flores. There is no principled basis upon which the result here should be different. Unless the court has any further questions, I will conclude.
Mr. McCoy, you have.
You said that there were no studies showing that drywall workers had an increased risk of this disease.
That's correct.
Are there studies showing that drywall workers do not have an increased risk of these diseases?
I don't know, because studies that don't find correlation never get published.
Well, you could do a study and find out, seemed to me that it was important, that they did not have an increased risk. So what you're saying is, from what I'm hearing you, there just aren't any studies.
Well, there
drywall workers.
There certainly aren't any published studies. And okay. And, of course, it is the plaintiff's burden to prove causation, not the defendant's burden to prove it, to dispute it.
Okay.
But as a practical matter, in epidemiology, studies that do not find correlation do not get published. The purpose of a statistical epidemiological study is to reject the null hypothesis. If it doesn't get rejected, the paper doesn't get published. Any further questions? I'll sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan. Mr. Siegel.
Thank you, Your Honor. I must say, I've never quite encountered this level of scorn for what's in the record or what's in the brief. And I have to say, if you read their brief, you'll see about three or four times the turn of phrase, the plaintiffs hope the court doesn't read the record, or the plaintiffs hope the court overlooks this fact, or the plaintiff hopes the court doesn't actually read this study. And again, as we said in our reply brief, I think they protesteth too much. We're very, very desirous that the court read the record and these studies. I do regret, as I say, making the argument about deciding that Stevens was wrong as the first argument in our opening brief. But the idea that we did not put on this dose evidence in the trial court or in our opening brief in this court is completely wrong. Ms. Jacobson has found in the record where we set out these precise calculations in our response to the motion for summary judgment in the trial court. That starts at page volume 6, page 1230 of the record. The same evidence is detailed starting at page 12 of our opening brief. So as an appellate practitioner, I apologize for deciding that I liked my second argument better once the reply brief came along, but I do hope to make it easier for the court, and I wish I had made it easier starting in the opening brief, and that is the court doesn't have to decide that Stevens was incorrectly decided. The court can feel free to chastise me for bad briefing tactics, but the evidence is in the record. It was set forth to the trial judge, and it was set forth in our opening brief. Now, one thing I think Kelly Moore wishes the court would overlook is, and what you didn't hear any mention of in this argument, was they stipulated that chrysotile can cause mesothelioma, period. All of that, so all of this business about other types of asbestos causing mesothelioma more than chrysotile is utterly beside the point. Why did they make that stipulation, since they don't usually give up arguments like that? They made it because Judge Davidson already had held a three-day hearing in which he decided that there is scientifically respectable and Havner-worthy and Daubert-worthy evidence that chrysotile causes mesothelioma, period. That's why they elected not to litigate that question in front of Judge Davidson. And if the court feels it necessary, I didn't think it was necessary, but if it is necessary, I'd be happy to supply that ruling of Judge Davidson's to the court. That's why they conceded that chrysotile asbestos causes mesothelioma. For what it's worth, we went into those studies again in the trial court and again in our opening brief. It's page 22 of our opening brief.
Well, wait a minute. On your handout, I gathered what he was saying was that your calculations here are based on asbestos in general and this particular chrysotile form of asbestos has a less likelihood of causing our disease we're discussing here, and so therefore you can't just take these general studies that would have six different types of fibers in it. You need to focus on the one, and this one has a much, according to opposing counsel, has a much less likelihood of causing it, so these numbers fall apart.
The problem is, there are three problems with that contention. One is, I think they might have argued that to the jury and may well have won on it, but it was not a reason to totally exclude this evidence or decide that it wasn't enough to create a fact issue about the relative potency of chrysotile. Second, the Selikoff study talks about these levels of exposure from drywall work, from joint compounds. And third, the most important thing is, Kelly Moore took that issue out of the case. That precise argument that Your Honor just voiced, or that skepticism that Your Honor just voiced, was taken out of the case by Kelly Moore. Why did they take it out of the case?
How was it taken out of the
case? Because they stipulated that chrysotile causes mesothelioma. Now, they may have gotten up in front of the jury and argued that, well, other kinds of asbestos cause mesothelioma more than others, but that's for the jury to decide. And that's for the jury to decide whether this study deals specifically with there is no study dealing with a Kelly Moore product. No, that kind of study has never been done. And if that's the kind of evidence that's required, i.e., a study of a man who through his entire career used only Kelly Moore joint compound, that is not going to exist. What we do have in this case, and again, I differ with Mr. Morgan. Mr. Morgan said there's no evidence that exposure to Kelly Moore by itself would have constituted enough, would have been enough evidence to get to the jury on specific causation. That's not true. That's what the ultimate calculation is. That is the result of these evidence and that of these studies and the plaintiff's expert opinion. There's a bit, well,
if go ahead. You, finish your thought and Judge McCoy's question, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. The argument is made that the plaintiffs sort of tried to distract everybody by using this theory that each and every exposure to asbestos anytime, anywhere, only once even, causes mesothelioma or is a cause. We don't rely on that theory. That is not the theory we rely on, and that the experts that we listed, Dr. Maddox and Dr. Longo, whose reports form the basis of the evidence here, would have testified to the jury about this ultimate conclusion, that even if he'd only worked 7.5 hours to 10.5 days, that would have been enough to cause his mesothelioma. And could the jury conclude that he worked with Kelly Moore 10.5 days over the course of his career? Of course they could have. So that's the evidence that Mr. Morgan says isn't in the record, but we say is, and we say is what differentiates this record from Stevens. Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Siegel. We appreciate your arguments. And Mr. Morgan, we appreciate your arguments, and we appreciate all counsel's briefing in this matter. Your case is submitted, and we will now ask the clerk to adjourn us.